The gallery included only three sides of the quadrangle, the fourth being shut off as a lobby or corridor. One side was used for dancing, and the opposite side for the supper table, while the intermediate part was less brilliantly lit and fitted with comfortable seats. Later in the evening Gwendolen was in one of these seats, and Grandcourt was standing near her. They were not talking to each other. She was leaning backward in her chair and he against the wall, and Deronda, happening to observe this, went up to ask her if she had resolved not to dance any more. Having himself been doing hard duty in this way among the guests, he thought he had earned the right to sink for a little while into the background, and he had spoken little to Gwendolen since their conversation at the piano the day before. Grandcourt's presence would only make it the easier to show that pleasure in talking to her even about trivialities which would be a sign of friendliness, and he fancied that her face looked blank. A smile beamed over it as she saw him coming, and she raised herself from her leaning posture. Grandcourt had been grumbling at the ennui of staying so long in this stupid dance, and proposing that they should vanish. She had resisted on the ground of politeness, not without being a little frightened at the probability that he was silently angry with her. She had her reason for staying, though she had begun to despair of the opportunity for the sake of which she had put the old necklace on her wrist. But now at last Deronda had come. "Yes, I shall not dance any more. Are you not glad?" she said, with some gaiety. "You might have felt obliged humbly to offer yourself as a partner, and I feel sure you have danced more than you like already."
"I will not deny that," said Deronda, "since you have danced as much as you like.
But will you take trouble for me in another way, and fetch me a glass of that fresh water?"
It was but a few steps that Deronda had to go for the water. Gwendolen was wrapped in the lightest, softest of her white woolen burnouses, under which her hands were hidden. While he was gone, she had drawn off her glove, which was finished with a lace ruffle, and when she put up her hand to take the glass and lifted it to her mouth, the necklace bracelet, which in its triple winding adapted itself clumsily to her wrist, was necessarily conspicuous. Grandcourt saw it, and saw that it was attracting Deronda's notice.
"What is that hideous thing you've got on your wrist?" said the husband.
"That," said Gwendolen composedly, pointing to the turquoises while she still held the glass, "it is an old necklace I like to wear. I lost it once, and someone found it for me." With that she gave the glass again to Deronda, who immediately carried it away, and on returning said, in order to banish any consciousness about the necklace, "It is worth while for you to go out and look at one of the windows on that side. You can see the finest possible moonlight on the stone pillars and carving, and shadows waving across it in the wind."
"I should like to see it.
Will you go?" said Gwendolen, looking up at her husband. He cast his eyes down at her, and saying, "No, Deronda will take you," slowly moving from his leaning attitude, and walked away. Gwendolen's face for a moment showed a fleeting vexation. She resented this show of indifference toward her. Deronda felt annoyed, chiefly for her sake, and with a quick sense that it would relieve her most to behave as if nothing peculiar had occurred, he said, "Will you take my arm and go, while only servants are there?" He thought that he understood well her action in drawing his attention to the necklace. She wished him to infer that she had submitted her mind to rebuke. Her speech and manner had from the first fluctuated toward that submission, and that she felt no lingering resentment. Her evident confidence in his interpretation of her appealed to him as a peculiar claim. When they were walking together, Gwendolen felt as if the annoyance which had just happened had removed another film of reserve from between them, and she had more right than before to be as open as she wished. She did not speak, being filled with a sense of silent confidence, until they were in front of the window looking out on the moonlit court. A sort of bower had been made round the window, turning it into a recess. Quitting his arm, she folded her hands in her burnous and pressed her brow against the glass. He moved slightly away and held the lapels of his coat with his thumbs under the collar, as his manner was. He had a wonderful power of standing perfectly still, and in that position reminded one sometimes of Dante's
"Spiriti mani con occhi tardi e grave."
Doubtless some of these danced in their youth, doubted of their own vocation, and found their own times too modern. He abstained from remarking on the scene before them, fearing that any indifferent words might jar on her.
Already the calm light and shadow, the ancient steadfast forms, and aloofness enough from those inward troubles which he felt sure were agitating her. And he judged aright, she would have been impatient of polite conversation. The incidents of the last minute or two had receded behind former thoughts which she had imagined herself uttering to Deronda, which now urged themselves to her lips. In a subdued voice she said, "Suppose I had gambled again and lost the necklace, what should you have thought of me?"
"Worse than I do now."
"Then you are mistaken about me. You wanted me not to do that, not to make my gain out of another's loss in that way, and I have done a great deal worse."
"I can't imagine temptation," said Deronda. "Perhaps I am able to understand what you mean. At least I understand self-reproach." In spite of preparation, he was almost alarmed at Gwendolen's precipitancy of confidence toward him, in contrast with her habitual resolute concealment.
"What should you do if you were like me, feeling that you were wrong and miserable and dreading everything to come?" It seemed that she was hurrying to make the utmost use of this opportunity to speak as she would.
"That is not to be amended by doing one thing only, but many," said Deronda decisively.
"What?" said Gwendolen hastily, moving her brow from the glass and looking at him. He looked full at her in return, with what she thought was severity. He felt that it was not a moment in which he must let himself be tender and flinch from implying a hard opinion.
"I mean there are many thoughts and habits that may help us to bear inevitable sorrow. Multitudes have to bear it." She turned her brow to the window again and said impatiently,
"You must tell me then what to think and what to do. Else why did you not let me go on doing as I liked and not minding? If I had gone on gambling, I might have won again, and I might have got not to care for anything else. You would not let me do that. Why shouldn't I do as I like and not mind? Other people do."
Poor Gwendolen's speech expressed nothing very clearly except her irritation. "I don't believe you would ever get not to mind," said Deronda, with deep-toned decision. "If it were true that baseness and cruelty made an escape from pain, what difference would that make to people who can't be quite base or cruel? Idiots escape some pain, but you can't be an idiot. Some may do wrong to another without remorse, but suppose one does feel remorse. I believe you could never lead an injurious life. All reckless lives are injurious, pestilential, without feeling remorse." Deronda's unconscious fervor had gathered as he went on. He was uttering thoughts which he had used for himself in moments of painful meditation.
"Then tell me what better I can do," said Gwendolen insistently.
"Many things. Look on other lives besides your own. See what their troubles are and how they are born. Try to care about something in this vast world besides the gratification of small selfish desires. Try to care for what is best in thought and action, something that is good apart from the accidents of your own lot." For an instant or two Gwendolen was mute. Then again, moving her brow from the glass, she said,
"You mean that I am selfish and ignorant."
He met her fixed look in silence before he answered firmly, "You will not go on being selfish and ignorant." She did not turn away her glance or let her eyelids fall, but a change came over her face, that subtle change in nerve and muscle which will sometimes give a childlike expression even to the elderly. It is the subsidence of self-assertion. "Shall I lead you back?" said Deronda gently, turning and offering her his arm again. She took it silently, and in that way they came in sight of Grandcourt, who was walking slowly near their former place. Gwendolen went up to him and said,
"I am ready to go now. Mr. Deronda will excuse us to Lady Mallinger."
"Certainly," said Deronda. "Lord and Lady Pentreath disappeared some time ago." Grandcourt gave his arm in silent compliance, nodding over his shoulder to Deronda, and Gwendolen too only half turned to bow and say,
"Thanks."
The husband and wife left the gallery and paced the corridors in silence. When the door had closed on them in the boudoir, Grandcourt threw himself into a chair and said with undertoned peremptoriness, "Sit down." She, already in the expectation of something unpleasant, had thrown off her burnous with nervous unconsciousness and immediately obeyed. Turning his eyes toward her, he began,
Oblige me in future by not showing whims like a mad woman in a play."
"What do you mean?" said Gwendolen.
"I suppose there is some understanding between you and Deronda about that thing you have on your wrist. If you have anything to say to him, say it. But don't carry on a telegraphing which other people are supposed not to see. It's damnably vulgar."
"You can know all about the necklace," said Gwendolen, her angry pride resisting the nightmare of fear.
"I don't want to know. Keep to yourself whatever you like."
Grandcourt paused between each sentence, and in each his speech seemed to become more preternaturally distinct in its inward tones.
"What I care to know, I shall know, without your telling me. Only you will please to behave as becomes my wife, and not make a spectacle of yourself."
"Do you object to my talking to Mr. Deronda?"
"I don't care two straws about Deronda or any other conceited hanger-on. You may talk to him as much as you like. He is not going to take my place. You are my wife, and you will either fill your place properly, to the world and to me, or you will go to the devil."
"I never intended anything but to fill my place properly," said Gwendolen, with bitterest mortification in her soul.
"You put that thing on your wrist and hid it from me till you wanted him to see it. Only fools go into that deaf and dumb talk and think their secret. You will understand that you are not to compromise yourself. Behave with dignity. That's all I have to say."
With that last word, Grandcourt rose, turned his face to the fire, and looked down on her. She was mute. There was no reproach that she dared to fling back at him in return for these insulting admonitions, and the very reason she felt them to be insulting was that their purport went with the most absolute dictate of her pride. What she would least like to incur was the making a fool of herself and being compromised. It was futile and irrelevant to try and explain that Deronda, too, had only been a monitor, the strongest of all monitors. Grandcourt was contemptuous, not jealous, contemptuously certain of all the subjection he cared for. Why could she not rebel and defy him? She longed to do it, but she might as well have tried to defy the texture of her nerves and the palpitation of her heart. Her husband had a ghostly army at his back that could close round her wherever she might turn. She sat in her splendid attire like a white image of helplessness, and he seemed to gratify himself with looking at her. She could not even make a passionate exclamation or throw up her arms as she would have done in her maiden days. The sense of his scorn kept her still. "Shall I ring?" he said, after what seemed to her a long while. She moved her head in assent, and after ringing he went to his dressing room. Certain words were gnawing within her. "The wrong you have done me will be your own curse." As he closed the door, the bitter tears rose, and the gnawing words provoked an answer.
"Why did you put your fangs into me and not into him?" It was uttered in a whisper, as the tears came up silently, but she immediately pressed her handkerchief against her eyes and checked her tendency to sob. The next day, recovering from the shuddering fit of this evening's scene, she determined to use the charter which Grandcourt had scornfully given her, and to talk as much as she liked with Deronda. But no opportunities occurred, and any little evidence she could imagine for creating them were rejected by her pride, which was now doubly active. Not toward Deronda himself, she was singularly free from alarm lest he should think her openness wanting in dignity. It was part of his power over her that she believed in him free from all misunderstanding as to the way in which she appealed to him, or rather that he should misunderstand her had never entered into her mind. But the last morning came, and still she had never been able to take up the dropped thread of their talk, and she was without devices. She and Grandcourt were to leave at 3 o'clock. It was too irritating that after a walk in the grounds had been planned in Deronda's hearing, he did not present himself to join in it. Grandcourt was gone with Sir Hugo to King's Topping to see the old manor house. Others of the gentlemen were shooting, and she was condemned to go and see the decoy and the waterfowl and everything else that she least wanted to see, with the ladies, with old Lord Pentreath and his anecdotes, with Mr. Vandernoot and his admiring manners. The irritation became too strong for her. Without premeditation, she took advantage of the winding road to linger a little out of sight,
and then set off back to the house, almost running when she was safe from observation. She entered by a side door, and the library was on her left hand. Deronda, she knew, was often there. Why might she not turn in there as well as into any other room in the house? She had been taken there expressly to see the illuminated family tree and other remarkable things. What more natural than that she should like to look in again? The thing most to be feared was that the room would be empty of Deronda, for the door was ajar. She pushed it gently and looked round it. He was there, writing busily at a distant table with his back toward the door. In fact, Sir Hugo had asked him to answer some constituents' letters which had become pressing. An enormous log fire with the scent of Russia from the books made the great room as warmly odorous as a private chapel in which the censers have been swinging. It seemed too daring to go in, too rude to speak and interrupt him. Yet she went in on the noiseless carpet and stood still for 2 or 3 minutes, till Deronda, having finished a letter, pushed it aside for signature, and threw himself back to consider whether there were anything else for him to do, or whether he could walk out for the chance of meeting the party which included Gwendolen, when he heard her voice saying, "Mr. Deronda!" It was certainly startling. He rose hastily, turned round, and pushed away his chair with a strong expression of surprise. "Am I wrong to come in?" said Gwendolen. "I thought you were far on your walk," said Deronda. "I turned back," said Gwendolen. "Do you intend to go out again? I could join you now if you would allow me." "No, I want to say something, and I can't stay long," said Gwendolen, speaking quickly in a subdued tone while she walked forward and rested her arms and muff on the back of the chair he had pushed away from him. "I want to tell you that it is really so. I can't help feeling remorse for having injured others. That was what I meant when I said that I had done worse than gamble again and pawn the necklace again, something more injurious, as you called it. And I can't alter it. I am punished, but I can't alter it. You said I could do many things. Tell me again, what should you do? What should you feel if you were in my place?" The hurried directness with which she spoke, the absence of all her little airs, as if she were only concerned to use the time in getting an answer that would guide her, made her appeal unspeakably touching. Deronda said, "I should feel something of what you feel, deep sorrow." "But what would you try to do?" said Gwendolen with urgent quickness. "Order my life so as to make any possible amends, and keep away from doing any sort of injury again," said Deronda, catching her sense that the time for speech was brief. "But I can't, I can't, I must go on," said Gwendolen in a passionate loud whisper. "I have thrust out others. I have made my gain out of their loss, tried to make it, tried. And I must go on. I can't alter it." It was impossible to answer this instantaneously. Her words had confirmed his conjecture, and the situation of all concerned rose in swift images before him. His feeling for those who had been thrust out sanctioned her remorse. He could not try to nullify it. Yet his heart was full of pity for her. But as soon as he could, he answered, taking up her last words, "That is the bitterest of all, to wear the yoke of our own wrongdoing. But if you submitted to that as men submit to their maiming or lifelong incurable disease, and made the unalterable wrong a reason for more effort toward a good, that may do something to counterbalance the evil. One who has committed irremediable errors may be scourged by that consciousness into a higher course than is common. There are many examples. Feeling what it is to have spoiled one life may well make us long to save other lives from being spoiled." "But you have not wronged anyone, or spoiled their lives," said Gwendolen hastily. "It is only others who have wronged you." Deronda colored slightly, but said immediately, "I suppose our keen feeling for ourselves might end in giving us a keen feeling for others, if, when we are suffering acutely, we were to consider that others go through the same sharp experience. That is a sort of remorse before commission. Can't you understand that?" "I think I do, now," said Gwendolen. "But you were right. I am selfish. I have never thought much of anyone's feelings except my mother's. I have not been fond of people. But what can I do?" she went on more quickly.
I must get up in the morning and do what everyone else does. It is all like a dance set beforehand. I seem to see all that can be, and I am tired and sick of it, and the world is all confusion to me." She made a gesture of disgust. "You say I am ignorant, but what is the good of trying to know more, unless life were worth more?"
"This good," said Deronda promptly, with a touch of indignant severity which he was inclined to encourage as his own safeguard, "life would be worth more to you. Some real knowledge would give you an interest in the world beyond the small drama of personal desires. It is the curse of your life, forgive me, of so many lives, that all passion is spent in that narrow round for want of ideas and sympathies to make a larger home for it. Is there any single occupation of mind that you care about with passionate delight or even independent interest?" Deronda paused, but Gwendolen, looking startled and thrilled as by an electric shock, said nothing, and he went on more insistently. "I take what you said of music for a small example. It answers for all larger things. You will not cultivate it for the sake of a private joy in it. What sort of earth or heaven would hold any spiritual wealth in it for souls pauperized by inaction? If one firmament has no stimulus for our attention and awe, I don't see how four would have it. We should stamp every possible world with the flatness of our own inanity, which is necessarily impious, without faith or fellowship. The refuge you are needing from personal trouble is the higher, the religious life, which holds an enthusiasm for something more than our own appetites and vanities. The few may find themselves in it simply by an elevation of feeling. But for us who have to struggle for our wisdom, the higher life must be a region in which the affections are clad with knowledge." The half-indignant remonstrance that vibrated in Deronda's voice came, as often happens, from the habit of inward argument with himself, rather than from severity toward Gwendolen. But it had a more beneficial effect on her than any soothings. Nothing is feebler than the indolent rebellion of complaint, and to be roused into a self-judgment is comparative activity. For the moment she felt like a shaken child, shaken out of its wailing into awe, and she said humbly, "I will try. I will think." They both stood silent for a minute, as if some third presence had arrested them. For Deronda, too, was under that sense of pressure which is apt to come when our own winged words seem to be hovering around us, till Gwendolen began again. "You said affection was the best thing, and I have hardly any, none about me. If I could, I would have mamma. But that is impossible. Things have changed to me so, in such a short time. What I used not to like, I long for now. I think I am almost getting fond of the old things, now they are gone." Her lip trembled. "Take the present suffering as a painful letting in of light," said Deronda more gently. "You are conscious of more beyond the round of your own inclinations. You know more of the way in which your life presses on others, and their life on yours. I don't think you could have escaped the painful process in some form or other."
"But it is a very cruel form," said Gwendolen, beating her foot on the ground with returning agitation. "I am frightened at everything. I am frightened at myself. When my blood is fired, I can do daring things, take any leap, but that makes me frightened at myself." She was looking at nothing outside her, but her eyes were directed toward the window, away from Deronda, who, with quick comprehension, said, "Turn your fear into a safeguard. Keep your dread fixed on the idea of increasing that remorse which is so bitter to you. Fixed meditation may do a great deal toward defining our longing or dread. We are not always in a state of strong emotion, and when we are calm we can use our memories and gradually change the bias of our fear, as we do our tastes. Take your fear as a safeguard. It is like quickness of hearing. It may make consequences passionately present to you. Try to take hold of your sensibility and use it as if it were a faculty, like vision." Deronda uttered each sentence more urgently. He felt as if he were seizing a faint chance of rescuing her from some indefinite danger. "Yes, I know. I understand what you mean," said Gwendolen, in her loud whisper, not turning her eyes, but lifting up her small gloved hand and waving it in deprecation of the notion that it was easy to obey that advice. "But if feelings rose, there are some feelings, hatred and anger. How can I be good when they keep rising? And if there came a moment when I felt stifled and could bear it no longer?" She broke off, and with agitated lips looked at Deronda, but the expression on his face pierced her with an entirely new feeling. He was under the baffling difficulty of discerning that what he had been urging on her was thrown into the pallid distance of mere thought before the outburst of her habitual emotion. It was as if he saw her drowning while his limbs were bound. The pained compassion which was spread over his features as he watched her affected her with a compunction unlike any she had felt before, and in a changed and imploring tone she said, "I am grieving you. I am ungrateful. You can help me. I will think of everything. I will try. Tell me, it will not be a pain to you that I have dared to speak of my trouble to you? You began it, you know, when you rebuked me." There was a melancholy smile on her lips as she said that, but she added more entreatingly, "It will not be a pain to you." "Not if it does anything to save you from an evil to come," said Deronda, with strong emphasis. "Otherwise, it will be a lasting pain."
"No, no, it shall not be. It may be, it shall be better with me because I have known you."
She turned immediately and quitted the room. When she was on the first landing of the staircase, Sir Hugo passed across the hall on his way to the library and saw her. Grandcourt was not with him. Deronda, when the baronet entered, was standing in his ordinary attitude, grasping his coat collar, with his back to the table, and with that indefinable expression by which we judge that a man is still in the shadow of a scene which he has just gone through. He moved, however, and began to arrange the letters.
"Has Mrs. Grandcourt been in here?" said Sir Hugo.
"Yes, she has."
"Where are the others?"
"I believe she left them somewhere in the grounds." After a moment's silence, in which Sir Hugo looked at a letter without reading it, he said,
"I hope you are not playing with fire, Dan. You understand me?"
"I believe I do, sir," said Deronda, after a slight hesitation which had some repressed anger in it. "But there is nothing answering to your metaphor. No fire, and therefore no chance of scorching." Sir Hugo looked searchingly at him and then said,
"So much the better. For, between ourselves, I fancy there may be some hidden gunpowder in that establishment."
End of chapter 36.
This recording is in the public domain.